and welcome to Sampler. I'm Brittany Luce, and this is the show where I guide you through the vast galaxy of podcasts, looking for shooting stars and crazy black holes to climb into. Today on the show, I'm excited because we have a very special guest, someone that I have watched on screen since I was a kid, Molly Ringwald. Of course, you know her movies, Pretty in Pink, The Breakfast Club, 16 Candles. But Molly Ringwald has many other sides to her. She's written two books, she's performed on Broadway, she made a jazz album, and
I listen to a lot of podcasts.
I'm glad, because that's basically what we're going to be talking about.
Oh, good. Yeah.
So for today's episode, we put together a playlist designed specially for Molly. Podcasts we thought she would love. Okay, let's get to the show.
I haven't actually listened to anything in a while. I'm finding I just moved back to New York from Los Angeles, and I used to do so much of my podcast listening in the car.
Yeah.
And now I don't have a car. So I'm trying to figure out exactly where and when to listen to podcasts.
Do you listen while cooking?
I don't do the cooking in my family. This is big confession. My husband does most of the cooking.
I will say a possible suggestion is, I don't know if you've tried this, laying down on the couch while your spouse is cooking and listening to podcasts.
I don't know if he'll like that very much, but I like the sound of that.
You have to get your listening in somehow. So there's, you know, I mean, there's consequences to everything.
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to start today with a podcast whose subject we know you are familiar with. Obviously, you've acted before.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever listen to like any Hollywood or movie podcasts?
No, I totally stay away from everything Hollywood.
Oh,
why do you have a Hollywood one?
We do. Well, it's not like this one is actually a little different. It's not contemporary.
Oh, okay.
It's this show called You Must Remember This. It's mm-hmm. actually it's hosted by this woman, Karina Longworth.
Is that a real name?
Yes. Isn't that gorgeous?
Yeah,
Karina Longworth.
Yeah, it sounds like a 30s. Actress.
No, that's actually that's like the era that she covers.
She made it up. She must have made it up.
Like her real name is like Norma Jean something.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So this podcast, You Must Remember This, focuses on the golden age of Hollywood. And Karina basically tells long stories of what she calls the secret or forgotten histories from Hollywood's first century. She researches everybody like crazy and seems to know absolutely everything about the actors and directors and players she talks about on the show. And she just constantly keeps pulling out surprises. The episode I picked for you today is about the movie actress Hedy Lamarr, who's known commonly as like this 1940s bombshell.
Yeah. I think I've only seen black and white pictures, but I imagine her eyes were like green or
yeah.
She had coloring a lot like Vivian Leigh.
Yes.
I think.
Yes.
But
yes,
like
yes.
A little bit more exotic looking.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Her hair looked like it was like raven jet black.
Yeah.
You could see your face in basically a wave of it if you really squint it.
Yeah.
But she also had another side to her that most people don't know about. And Karina talks about that other side of Hedy.
Off the clock, Hedy did little to burnish her rep as a glamour puss. She didn't drink, she was rarely spotted at the fashionable clubs, and she eschewed big fêtes for intimate dinner parties. She spent a lot of her money building a prodigious art collection, and in her free time, she sat at a drafting table in her drawing room, sketching out ideas for inventions. No one was more cynical about Hedy's appeal than Hedy herself. She famously said, "Any girl can be glamorous. All she has to do is to stand still and look stupid."
But Hedy wanted to be known for more than her looks, and she really wanted to help America during World War II. Back in her native Austria, Hedy had been married to this guy who worked as a weapons manufacturer. She attended dinners with all the big players in the weapons business, so she knew a lot about the other side and their weapons. And she couldn't stop thinking about what she could do with this information. You know, so she got to talking about this over late-night dinners with her neighbor, George Antal. Now, George was an inventor himself, but his work was about as far from weapons manufacturing as you can get. His inventions were focused on the player piano. But even though George and Hedy came from two very different backgrounds, they found themselves collaborating.
Hedy's idea, as she presented it to Antal, was to set up a remote-controlled torpedo, utilizing a system of wireless communication so that the signals controlling the weapon remotely would be impossible for the enemy to jam. This would be accomplished by having both the transmitter of the signal and the receiver constantly shift frequencies at random but in unison. Hedy called this concept frequency hopping. Antal suggested they borrow a mechanism from one of his own inventions, a piano teaching tool called C-Note, which involved two synchronized player piano scrolls, each of them equipped with 88 frequencies. Hetty and George started meeting regularly to perfect what was now a collaborative concept for a weapon which could be operated by a frequency-hopping signal controlled by ribbons, perforated with instructive data in the style of player piano scrolls. They first contacted the National Inventors Council in December 1940, and the response was encouraging. In June 1941, they submitted a patent application for what they were now calling the Secret Communication System, with Hetty using her married name, Hetty Kiesler Markey, on the patent. When Hetty and George got word that their patent application was accepted, they turned the patent over to the U.S. government in the hopes that it would be useful in the ongoing war somehow. And Hetty again suggested that she should quit movies and go to Washington to help out on the innovation front. But the government was like, nah. Hetty was told her talents would be better put to work inspiring the sale of war bonds.
Hetty never got money for her patent, but it paved the way for future technology. Technology that we still use today and that many of you may be using right now. You know, it's crazy to think about, but the foundation for wireless communication was laid by, of all people, a movie star. And stories like this are why I love this podcast. You know, it explores people's Hollywood legends or their Hollywood legacies, just really in full.
It's amazing. But I sort of just wonder why more people don't know that. Why is that something that people aren't familiar with?
I don't know.
I mean, I'm sorry like to get into the whole, you know, gender bias thing, but
don't apologize.
You know,
we love that angle.
But I mean, come on. If it was an actor, if it was a guy who invented this technology, I feel like everyone would know about it. I feel like it wouldn't be this sort of carefully kept secret.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
It's one of those things I think about, like, if I were her, you know, obviously, yes, I would want my legacy to include, like, how shiny my hair was, how great my bone structure was, and how great of an actress I was.
Yeah.
But, like, I would definitely want people to know that I was basically responsible in many ways for inventing Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
It's one of those things, once you, like, are that huge, you kind of, like, in a way, and I'm hypothesizing because you're actually probably one of the few guests who'll be able to, like, confirm whether or not this is true. But in a way, like, there's a part of you that doesn't belong to you. In that, like, other people can kind of pick and choose which parts of your legacy live on. How would you like to be remembered? And, if far in the future, they're, like, you know, Karina Longworth's granddaughter.
that's a really interesting question. And I'm not, I mean, I can tell you how I think I will be remembered. I think no matter what I do in my life, I think most people will see me leaning over a cake on a table, you know, trying not to set my dress on fire, kissing a really cute guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, those films that I did, I think they don't really belong to me anymore. They belong to everyone else. And I'm just like a part of them. And I'm sort of like a receptacle for people's memories. So I think no matter what, that's just going to be a part of my legacy. And I'm okay with that. I mean, I think to be known for something that I actually like. But there's a lot of other things that I do that I hope don't get overlooked.
Like what?
You know, well, like stuff that I've written or, you know, just me as a person, the kind of person that I am or the kind of mother that I am. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like, I don't know, it's going to be really interesting to see. I mean, I won't be around, obviously, to see how I'm portrayed. But when that happens, I hope that I haven't made too many mistakes, I guess.
All right, so we're going to get into something that's kind of, I think wacky would be a good way to describe that. So this is a podcast by these, okay. Well, I guess it's by these two women who go by the name of Rawna and Beverly.
Okay.
So two women from the Upright Citizens Brigade, they created these personas of two Jewish women in their 50s who are from Boston. And they basically shell out advice.
Okay.
And interview celebrities.
Okay.
So in this next clip.
Wait a minute. Who play the women?
The comedians are Jessica Chafin and Jamie Denbo. And the clip I'm going to play for you today is from an episode they actually did in November when their guest was actress Jessica St. Clair. She's going to be the third voice you hear in this clip.
I don't like any ice cream that tastes like soap.
How exactly. Did you? Or rosemary?
No, yeah, thank you.
No, it's like, go, that's why I can't go into Lush. That's
no, me neither.
Anywhere they want to cut soap like food,
no,
I can't get involved.
No, it's not the same.
It's absolutely true.
It's like not disgusting. A jelly roll. It's a goddamn bar.
No, it looks like chocolate. And it's not.
Can I ask
you a question?
Yeah, it's
when you use a bar of soap in the shower,
do you rub?
She doesn't. Okay. That would be number one.
All right. Well, Jessica,
yeah.
When you use a bar of soap,
yeah.
Do you rub the bar right on you, or do you rub it on your hands
right on
and
me.
Then so use
I
your hands?
I will tell you, I recently was turned on to a new bar of soap.
So is it what? Trader Joe's oatmeal?
It is not.
I love that one.
It is a very exclusive bar of soap.
French kind of.
No, they sell it at a friend of mine whose husband,
oh,
who is a plastic surgeon,
is it Dove
sells
sensitive?
It at his. They sell it at his office. It's some sort of a dermatologist soap. She sent it to me. Deborah Zimbler, if you're listening, sent me this soap. It is so fabulous. It's an exfoliating soap. They call it like a microdermabrasion soap.
That's exactly what they have at Trader Joe's.
And it feels like razor blades on your skin.
That feels good.
Yes.
I like that
it's
feeling.
It's a wonderful
Are you
feeling.
Out of your mind.
Because we shouldn't like be Clarisonic. I heard that we shouldn't be using a Clarisonic anymore.
It feels like taking sandpaper.
That feels
and
good.
And ripping
like
skin
a cat
off of your body.
Is licking.
Yes,
like a million
exactly,
cats are licking
exactly
you.
Exactly
okay, If I may, I'd like
I'll
to stand up
called.
As the voice of reason in this conversation.
Yeah.
I don't believe you should be shedding your skin like a gecko. All the time. Just because you two girls
That's really funny. They're really good.
Aren't they so good?
Have you ever heard what they actually sound like when they're not doing those voices?
I actually haven't. And I am
you
nervous.
Kind of don't want to.
Yeah. It'll spoil like the. Because they're so, like, in my mind, can't you so clearly see them?
Yeah, totally.
They look like that old, I don't know if you ever, the shoebox brand, like, I think it's like Hallmark cards. They have this old woman who smokes and wears sunglasses indoors and has, like, a cat. and, like, that's, like, I so clearly see. It's like coffee talk.
Yeah.
But, like, kicked up a notch because of these Boston accents.
Yeah. One of them kind of sounds like Joan Rivers.
Right.
I mean, with a Boston accent.
Yeah. I mean, a Boston accent, it's not. It doesn't go down on the ear really easily.
No. I mean, I kind of like it. I like any sort of accent, you know. I had to learn how to do a Boston accent for a television series that I did.
How did you practice that?
I don't know. Just like the pack, the can, yad, and mom instead of mom.
Yeah.
It was not so easy to learn how to do it.
Yeah. And the fact that you were able to pick it up, my God.
It took work.
All right, so we're going to pause and take a quick break, but when we come back, we go deep. Hi, and welcome back to Sampler. I'm your host, Brittany Luce, guiding you through the vast depths that make up the podcast universe. And today, I'm interviewing and playing a few clips for actress, writer, and podcast lover, Molly Ringwald. So the next clip is from a show called The Mental Illness Happy Hour, which, gosh, the more I say it, the more I'm like, that's such a genius title.
it is a great title.
It's a really great title. So it's a podcast hosted by Paul Gilmartin, and he interviews people about their mental health histories. I picked this podcast because I think we could all agree that it still feels a little taboo to share intimate details of mental health struggles. And having these people just kind of bravely lay out, even if they can't necessarily describe how they feel, sometimes just laying out what it is that they feel compelled to do
mm-hmm.
or what it is that they feel that they have to do to sort of just remain functioning, it paints a very clear picture of what it's like to be in that position.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Some of them are known people that you've seen on TV or you've read their work or you've seen them tell jokes. And kind of demystifying and taking some of the stigma and shame away from that. It was one of the goals of Paul's in starting the show. And I found it personally super helpful. So I love this episode because it's just very honest. It's with a comedian named Sarah Benincasa. So I know her from her time at MTV when she covered the 2008 election. But what I didn't know about her is that she struggles really seriously with agoraphobia. Oh, and just a warning, this next clip has some adult language.
So agoraphobia for me at the worst point was me staying in, restricting myself largely to one section of my studio apartment in Boston. So just being in, I was trying to stay in my bed to the point where I would urinate in bowls and in jars and like hide them under my bed, even though no one was coming to look for them. And so that, I mean, if I had to like take a shit, I would go to the bathroom. I never got to a place. I was like, that's just crazy. I'm never getting to that place.
When you have a fear, like I can understand the fear of leaving your apartment. Walk me through the fear of leaving your bed to go pee. Is it a fear or is it that it just, it, what does it feel like that is between you and just getting up to pee?
I think you just get addicted to the soothing drug that is sleep. And the bed becomes, when you're an agoraphobe, you paint yourself quite almost literally into a corner. You start splattering paint on all the places where you have panic attacks. So you start with, say, specifically Star Market on Newbury Street, which I don't even know if it exists. And then that expands from not just Star Market, but, you know, you're at Whole Foods and you have, there was a place called Bread and Circus in Boston back then. You have a panic attack at the organic grocery store, not just at the standard grocery store. So now you decide, you know what? It's not the grocery store I go to. It's all grocery stores. So you sort of paint over them and you can't be there. Then you go to a record shop.
And is this a thing that you are just feeling, or is it a thing that you're thinking intellectually, or is it both?
I think it was largely unconscious for me. Your animal child brain is thinking like, something bad happened there, don't go there. Something bad happened there, don't go to places that look like there. Something bad happened there, don't go to any place located near there. So it's not, it becomes, you know, from one store to the entire block, to the whole street, to a whole town, to, you know, whatever. You start to eliminate places that are, that you decide are unsafe.
That is heavy.
Yeah.
I have somebody in my life who's really close to me who has agoraphobia and panic attacks. And it's been really hard for me to wrap my brain around it. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking that, you know, she's making it up, you know, and then I'll think, oh, she's not making it up. This is real. Yeah. But then I don't understand. I can't really understand it. So listening to that was really, really heavy. And sort of makes me feel like I need to be a little bit more compassionate with a person in my life, because it's really a struggle. I mean, a lot of times we'll make a date to see each other and then she'll back out at the last minute because she'll have a panic attack. That was sort of, I think, one of the clearest descriptions I've heard about what it feels like in the inside, because the person in my life is not able to put it into words as clearly as this woman could. So I'm definitely going to go back to that podcast.
Oh, you definitely should. You're hearing about somebody struggling with mental illness without them being like in crisis, or even you think about a show like Intervention, a lot of that type of entertainment is engineered around, you know, seeming to constantly be in crisis. Somebody who's struggling with it, but like is lucid enough, you know, and reflective enough to be able to express it and talk about it for, you know, as long as they feel like need to.
Yeah. Well, it's impossible to have any sort of clarity when you're in the middle of it, I think. I've done The Moth a few times, and I've talked to Catherine, the director, Catherine Burns, and she talks about one of the things that she looks for in stories is people who are far enough away from the, whatever story they're telling, so that it comes from a scar and not from a wound.
Oh, that's such an incredible way to put that. And I totally love The Moth. I guess we should explain what The Moth is. It's a live show where people tell personal stories in front of an audience. And, you know, sometimes there are special appearances, I guess, by actors, obviously, like you, but you know, who share their own stories. But I love how you described these stories as coming from scars and not wounds. You know, you've already processed it. A couple of years ago, you told a story at The Moth about your daughter, Matilda, right?
Yeah. Matilda mm-hmm. is my my obsession and my thorn and my yeah. and my muse, and you know, I love her. She's my daughter. I find her the most endlessly interesting person I mm-hmm. know. So I tend to talk about her a lot. And so the moth story that I told was about a very difficult year that I had with her when she was 7 years old. Mm-hmm. But when I told the story, she was already in a different place. We had gotten through the year, and yeah. I was able to look back on this very charged year that I had with her. And I felt like I had some lucidity and I had some clarity, mm-hmm. and I was definitely able to talk about it with that distance. But if somebody asked me to talk about it while I was going through that, I would have just been a mess.
Actually, let me pull that up right now and let's listen to a bit of that performance about that year. Your daughter had just changed schools and was having a tough time with the other kids.
The first week, we knew that something was wrong when her teacher said to us at the first, you know, week conference, you know, in all my years of teaching, which was 16 years, I've never had a child like Matilda. You know, sometimes somebody can say this about your kid and you think, wow, that's amazing. But in our case, we knew it wasn't very good. She said, you know, she amended it and said, you know, maybe boys, but not girls. And we said, oh, all right, okay, what's up, gender bias? but, you know, we had to listen to what she had to say. She presented us with an index card that was clearly in Matilda's handwriting that said, you're pretty short and little for a second grader, which I thought was sort of alarming until I realized that it was actually written to a little boy. And I thought, she's flirting. I did that until I was well into my 30s, you know? But then there were other things that we really couldn't ignore. You know, she told one girl that she had a pretty awful name, but that she could change it when she turned 18. And then there were other incidences, you know, when she would get mad if she thought somebody was laughing at her, she would throw a sharp pencil at them. Or sometimes she would go up to their desk and just tear up their work. So it was clearly a problem. And then they would give in schools, in public schools, at least in Los Angeles, they do this thing called a reflection chart. And what it is they tell the child to explain what they did and why they did it and how they felt. And then the next part is how the other child might have felt. And that's to, you know, instill some kind of empathy. And what Matilda would write in the space was, blah, blah, blah. And translated, that's the 8-year-old version of fuck you. So Pawnee and I...
She still hasn't listened to the moth talk.
How long do you think you're going to wait for that one?
Well, I hosted an event for the moth and I wanted to bring her with me. And mm-hmm. so I had to tell her about it. And I sort of framed it in a way like it's been really helpful to a lot of people, because a lot of people did come up to me afterwards and say that, you know, they had a similar experience with their kid.
Yeah.
They loved to hear, you know, how I got through it. I mean, I got a lot of letters from people. And so I feel like it really sort of helped people. So when I presented it to her, I sort of came at it from that angle, like already like this thing happened and it's been so helpful to people and you're a part of it. It's our story, you know?
This is great.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure she saw right through it, but that's sort of what I did. And then I said, you know, she said, is it going to make me upset? And I said, I don't think so, but maybe you'd want to wait for a few years when there's even more time that's passed. I mean, she was 7 years old. She yeah. was like a really little girl, and she's 12 now. But I told her that she might want to wait even more. And she said, okay, I'm going to wait. I said, maybe. She said, well, how long? Like 5 years? And I said, yeah. Like, why don't you wait 5 years and then listen to it?
Yeah.
So she said, okay, I'm okay with that. So I don't think, unless she went and listened to it by herself, which yeah. is possible.
Yeah. Yeah, that is possible, but maybe not for a little while, though.
Yeah.
I remember when I was like kind of like a do-goodery child at 12 still.
Yeah.
So yeah, pretty much if like my parents told me I had to wait 5 years, I'd be like, all right. Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too. Yeah. Matilda's not that person at all. She's never been that person. And it sort of confounds me and her father. Like, we were both such do-gooders. Like, we were both totally like towed the line. I mean, I got more rebellious as I got older.
Yeah.
You know, I was definitely rebellious, I think, in my 20s and stuff. But like at her age, I was, you know, super, super good, like good child. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, not that she's not good. She's
an independent thinker.
She is. She's an iconoclast, for sure.
Gosh, iconoclast at 12. I need to catch up. Well, thank you, Molly, very, 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 very much.
Oh, we're done?
Yeah.
We're no more podcasts?
No more podcasts. It is, yeah.
Well, that was a good selection, though.
Oh, I'm glad.
I'm definitely going to revisit all of these shows.
Do you feel like we have helped you beef up your playlist?
Definitely.
Good.
Definitely. And I really kind of needed it. You know, I've been listening to the same podcast for a while, so I need some fresh blood.
Yeah, that's what we're here for.
Fresh podcast blood.
Fresh podcast. That's what we should have named the show instead. Maybe next week it won't even be Sampler. It'll just be like fresh blood. Okay, so just to recap, the shows you heard today on Molly's playlist, in order, were our Hollywood History show, You Must Remember This. We also checked in with two Boston girls, Rana and Beverly. And then after the break, we played a clip from the Mental Illness Happy Hour. And you just heard a snippet from Molly's appearance on The Moth. Links to these shows can be found at our website, gimletmedia.com/sampler. This episode of Sampler was produced by Chris Neary, Matthew Nelson, Rose Reed, and myself. It was edited by Peter Clowney, Caitlin Kenny, and Annie Rose Strasser. Our theme music was made by Mike Avellian, and our ad music was made by Build Buildings. Other original music in the show was written and performed by Peter Kakoma. This episode was mixed by David Herman. Sampler is a production of Gimlet Media. The name of the show is Sampler. If you could just say goodbye to the audience.
I'm Molly Ringwald. Thanks for listening to Sampler. Terrible. I'm Molly Ringwald. Thanks for listening to Sampler.
That was perfect.
That was way better.
Tune in next week to hear Gimlet CEO and startup host Alex Bloomberg share his favorite podcast moments and explain the joys of parenting.
You know how when you're in love with somebody and everybody's like, they're bad news, and you're like, but I love them. It's that. Like, kids are definitely bad news. Like, they are maniacal, psychopathic monsters.